My parents would fight too. She bit her lip and focused her whole mind on staying on board. When they reached the closest approach of the hover path to his parents' house, David jumped off and dashed down the slope. Tally realized that the board still wasn't fully charged and took a moment to unfold it before following, in no hurry to discover what the specials had done to Maddie and Az. But when she thought of David finding his parents on his own, Tally ran after him. It took her long minutes to find the path in the dense brush. Two nights ago, they had come in the dark and from a different direction. She listened for David, but couldn't hear anything. But then the wind shifted and the smell of smoke came through the trees. Burning the house hadn't been easy. Set into the mountain, the stone walls and roof had provided no fuel for the fire. But the attackers had evidently thrown something inside that had contained its own fuel. The windows were blown outward, glass littering the grass in front of the house, nothing left of the door but a few charred scraps swinging on their hinges in the breeze. David stood in front, unable to cross the threshold. "Stay here," Tally said. She stepped through the doorway, but the air overpowered her for the first moments. Morning light slanted in, picking out floating particles of ash. They swirled around Tally, little spiral galaxies set in motion by her passage. The blackened floorboards crumbled under her feet, burned away to bare stone in some places. But some things had survived the fire. She remembered the marble statuette from her visit, and one of the rugs hanging on the wall remained mysteriously untouched. In the parlor, a few teacups stood out, white against the charred furniture. Tally picked one up, realizing that if these cups had survived, a human body would leave more than traces. She swallowed. If David's parents had been here, whatever was left of them would be easy to find. Deeper into the house, in the small kitchen, city-made pots and pans hung from the ceiling, their warped, blackened metal still shining through in a few spots. Tally noted a bag of flour, and a few pieces of dried fruit somehow made her empty stomach growl. The bedroom was last. The stone ceiling was low and angled, the paint cracked and blackened from the heat of a raging fire. Tally felt the heat still rising from the bed, the straw mattress and thick quilts fuel for the conflagration. But Az and Maddie had not been there. There was nothing in the room that could have been human remains. Tally sighed with relief and made her way back outside, rechecking every room. She shook her head as she stepped through the door. Either the specials took them or they got away. David nodded and pushed past her. Tally collapsed on the ground and coughed, her lungs finally protesting against the smoke and dust particles she had inhaled. Her hands and arms were black with soot, she realized. When David came out, he held a long knife. "Hold out your hands." "What?" "The handcuffs. I can't stand them." She nodded and held out her hands. He carefully threaded the blade between the flesh and plastic, working it back and forth to saw the cuffs. A solid minute later, he pulled the knife away in frustration. "It's not working." Tally looked closer. The plastic had hardly been marked. She hadn't seen how the special had snipped her handcuffs in two behind her, but it had only taken a moment. Perhaps they'd used a chemical trigger. "Maybe it's some kind of aircraft plastic," she said. "Some of that stuff is stronger than steel." David frowned. "So how did you get them apart?" Tally opened her mouth, but nothing came out. She could hardly tell him that the specials had released her themselves. "And why do you have two cuffs on each wrist, anyway?" She looked down dumbly, remembering that they'd handcuffed her first when she was captured, then again in front of Dr. Cable, before taking her to look for the pendant. "I don't know," Tally managed. "I guess they double-cuffed us. But breaking out was easy. I cut them on a sharp rock." "That doesn't make sense." David looked at the knife. Dad always said this was the most useful thing he'd ever brought from the city. It's all high-tech alloys and monofilaments. She shrugged. Maybe the part that joined the cuffs was made out of different stuff. He shook his head, not quite accepting her story. Finally, he shrugged. Oh well, we'll just have to live with them. But one thing's for sure. My parents didn't get away.
How do you know?
He held up the knife. If he'd had any warning, my dad never would have left without this. The specials must have surprised them completely.
Oh, I'm sorry, David.
At least they're alive. He looked into her eyes, and Tally saw that his panic had faded. So, Tally, do you still want to go after them?
Yes, of course.
David smiled. Good. He sat next to her, looking back at the house and shaking his head. It's funny. Mom always warned me that this would happen. They tried to prepare me the whole time I was growing up. And for a long while, I believed them. But after all those years, I started to wonder. Maybe my parents were just being paranoid. Maybe, like runaways always said, special circumstances wasn't real. Tally nodded silently, not trusting herself to speak. And now that it's happened, it seems even less real.
I'm sorry, David.
But he could never know how sorry. Not until she'd help save his parents, at least.
Don't worry, we'll find them.
One stop to make first.
Where?
As I said, my parents were ready for this. Ever since they founded the smoke, they made preparations.
Like making sure you could take care of yourself, she said, touching the soft leather of his handmade jacket.
He smiled at her, rubbing soot from her cheek with one finger. They did a lot more than that. Come with me. In a cave near the house, the opening so small that Tally had to crawl inside on her belly, David showed her the cache of gear his parents had tended for 20 years. There were water purifiers, direction finders, lightweight clothes, and sleeping bags. By Smoky standards, an absolute fortune in survival equipment. The four hoverboards had old-fashioned styling, but they were fitted with the same features as the one Dr. Cable had supplied Tally with for the trip to the smoke, and there was a package of spare belly sensors sealed against moisture. Everything was of the highest quality.
Wow, they did plan ahead.
Always, he said. He picked up a flashlight and tested its beam against the stone. Every time I came here to check on stuff, I would imagine this moment. A million times I planned exactly what I would need. It's almost like I imagined it so much that it had to happen.
It's not your fault, David.
If I'd been here, you'd be in a special circumstances hover car right now, handcuffed, not likely to rescue anyone. Yeah, and instead, I'm here. He looked at her. But at least you are too. You're the one thing I never imagined all those times. An unexpected ally.
She managed to smile.
He pulled out a big waterproof bag. I'm starving. Tally nodded, and her head swam for a moment. She hadn't eaten since dinner 2 nights before. David rummaged through the bag. Plenty of instant food. Let's see. Veggie rice, curry nudes, sweet balls, pad thai. Any favorites? Tally took a deep breath. Back to the wild. Anything but spag bowl. The Oil Plague. Tally and David left at sunset. Each of them rode 2 hoverboards. Pressed together like a sandwich, the paired boards could carry twice as much weight, most of it in the saddlebag slung on the underside. They packed everything useful they could find, along with the magazines the boss had saved. Whatever happened, there would be no point in returning to the smoke. Tally took the river down the mountain carefully,
the extra weight swaying below her like a ball and chain around both ankles. At least she was wearing crash bracelets again. Their journey would follow a path very different from the one Tally had taken there. The route had been designed to be easy to follow and had included a helicopter ride with the Rangers. This one wouldn't be as direct. Overloaded as they were, Tally and David couldn't manage even short distances on foot. Every inch of the journey had to be over hoverable land and water, no matter how far it took them out of their way. And after the invasion, they would be giving any cities a wide berth. Fortunately, David had made the journey to and from Tally's city dozens of times, alone and with inexperienced uglies in tow. He knew the rivers and rails, the ruins and natural veins of ore, and dozens of escape routes he devised in case he was ever pursued by city authorities. 10 days, he announced when they started, if we ride all night and stay low during the day. Sounds good, Tally said, but she wondered if that would be soon enough to save anyone from the operation. Around midnight the first night of travel, they left the brook that led down to the bald-headed hill and followed a dry creek bed through the white flowers. It took them to the edge of a vast desert. How do we get through that? David pointed at dark shapes rising up from the sand, a row of them receding into the distance. Those used to be towers, connected by steel cables. What for? They carried electricity from a wind farm to one of the old cities. Tally frowned. I didn't know the Rusties used wind power. They weren't all crazy, just most of them. He shrugged. You've got to remember, we're mostly descended from Rusties, and we're still using their basic technology. Some of them must have had the right idea. The cables still lay buried in the desert, protected by the shifting sands and a near total absence of rainfall. In spots, they had broken or rusted through, so Tally and David had to ride carefully, eyes glued to the board's metal detectors. When they reached a gap they couldn't jump, they would unroll a long piece of cable David carried, then walk the boards along it, guiding them like reluctant donkeys across some narrow footbridge before rolling it up again. Tally had never seen a real desert before. She'd been taught in school that they were full of life, but this one was like the desert she'd imagined as a little, featureless humps stretching into the distance, one after another. Nothing moved but slow snakes of sand borne by the wind. She only knew the name of one big desert on the continent. Is this the Mojave? David shook his head. This isn't nearly that big, and it isn't natural. We're standing where the white weed started. Tally whistled. The sand seemed to go forever. What a disaster. Once the undergrowth was gone, replaced by the orchids, there was nothing to hold the good soil down. It blew away, and all that's left is sand. Will it ever be anything but desert? Sure, in 1,000 years or so. Maybe by then someone will have found a way to stop the weed from coming back. If we haven't, the process will just start all over again. They reached a rusty city around daybreak, a cluster of unremarkable buildings stranded on the sea of sand. The desert had invaded over the centuries, dunes flowing through the streets like water. But the buildings were in better shape than other ruins Tally had seen. Sand wore away the edges of things, but it didn't tear them down as hungrily as rain and vegetation. Neither of them was tired yet, but they couldn't travel during the day. The desert offered no protection from the sun, nor any concealment from the air. They camped in the second floor of a low factory building that still had most of its roof. Ancient machines, each as big as a hover car, stood silent around them. What was this place? Tally asked. I think they made newspapers here, David said. Like books, but you threw them away and got a new one every day. You're kidding. Not at all. And you thought we wasted trees in the smoke. Tally found a patch of sun shining through where the roof had collapsed and unfolded the hoverboards to recharge. David pulled out 2 packets of egg sal. "Will we make it out of the desert tonight?" she asked, watching David coax their last few drops of bottled water into the purifiers.
"No problem. We'll hit the next river before midnight."
She remembered something that Shay had said a long time ago, the first time she'd shown Tally her survival gear. "Can you really pee in a purifier? And then drink it, I mean?"
"Yeah, I've done it."
Tally grimaced and looked out the window.
"Okay, I shouldn't have asked."
He came up behind her, laughing softly, placing his hands on her shoulders.
"It's amazing what people will do to survive," he said.
She sighed. "I know." The window overlooked a side street, partly protected from the encroaching desert. A few burned-out ground cars stood half-buried, their blackened frames stark against the white sand. She rubbed the handcuff bracelets, still encircling her wrists.
"The Rusties sure wanted to survive.
Every ruin I've seen, those cars are always all over, trying to get out, but they never seem to make it."
"A few of them did, but not in cars."
Tally leaned back into his reassuring warmth. The morning sun was hours away from burning off the chill of the desert. "It's funny. At school, they never talk much about how it happened. The last panic, when the rusty world fell apart. They shrug and say that all their mistakes just kept adding up until it all collapsed like a house of cards."
"That's only partly true. The boss had some old books about it."
"What did they say?"
"Well, the Rusties did live in a house of cards, but someone gave it a pretty big shove. No one ever found out who. Maybe it was a rusty weapon that got out of control. Maybe it was people in some poor country who didn't like the way the Rusties ran things. Maybe it was just an accident, like the flowers, or some lone scientist who wanted to mess things up."
"But what happened?"
"A bug got loose, but it didn't infect people. It infected petroleum."
"Oil got infected?"
He nodded. "Oil is organic, made from old plants and dinosaurs and stuff. Somebody made a bacterium that ate it. The spores spread through the air, and when they landed in petroleum, processed or crude, they sprouted, like a mold or something. It changed the chemical composition of the oil. Have you ever seen phosphorus?"
"It's an element, right?"
"Yeah. And it catches fire on contact with air."
Tally nodded. She remembered playing with the stuff in chem class, wearing goggles and talking about all the tricks you could do with it. But no one ever thought of a trick that wouldn't kill someone.
"Oil infected by this bacterium was just as unstoppable as phosphorus. It exploded on contact with oxygen. And as it burned, the spores were released in the smoke and spread on the wind, until the spores got to the next car, or airplane, or oil well, it started growing again."
"Wow. And they used oil for everything, right?"
David nodded. "Like those cars down there. They must have been infected as they tried to get out of town."
"Why didn't they just walk?"
"Stupid, I guess."
Tally shivered again, but not from the cold. It was hard to think of the Rusties as actual people, rather than just an idiotic, dangerous, and sometimes comic force of history. But there were human beings down there, whatever was left of them after a couple of 100 years, still sitting in their blackened cars, as if still trying to escape their fate.
"I wonder why they don't tell us that in history class. They usually love any story that makes the Rusties sound pathetic."
David lowered his voice.
"Maybe they didn't want you to realize that every civilization has its weakness. There's always one thing we depend on. And if someone takes it away, all that's left is some story in a history class."
"Not us," she said. "Renewable energy, sustainable resources, a fixed population." The 2 purifiers pinged,
and David left her to get them.
"It doesn't have to be about economics," he said, bringing the food over. "The weakness could be an idea."
She turned to take her egg sal, cupping its warmth in her hands, and saw how serious he looked.
"So, David, is that one of the things you thought about all those years, when you imagined the smoke being invaded? Did you ever wonder what would turn the cities into history?"
He smiled and took a big bite.
"It gets clearer every day."
Familiar sights. They reached the edge of the desert the next night, on schedule, then followed a river for 3 days, all the way to the sea. It took them still farther north, and then the October chill turned as cold as any winter Tally had ever felt. David unpacked city-made Arctic gear of shiny silver mylar, which Tally wore over her handmade sweater, her only possession left from the smoke. She was glad she dropped off to sleep in it the night before the specials had invaded, so it hadn't been lost that day, like everything else. The night spent on board seemed to pass quickly. On this journey, there were none of Shay's cryptic clues to puzzle through, no brush fires to escape, no antique rusty machines descending to scare her to death. The world seemed to be empty, except for the occasional ruins, as if Tally and David were the last people alive. They augmented their diet with fish caught from the river, and Tally roasted a rabbit on a fire she'd built herself. She watched David repair his leather clothes and decided she would never be able to manage a needle and thread well. He taught her how to tell time and direction from the stars, and she showed him how to open the expert software in the boards to optimize them for night travel. At the sea, they turned south, heading down the northern reaches of the same coastal railway that Tally had followed on her way to the smoke. David said it had once stretched unbroken all the way back to Tally's home city and beyond. But now there were large gaps in the track, and new cities built on the sea, so they had to travel inland more than once. But David knew the rivers, the spurs of the railroad, and the other metal paths the Rusties had left behind, so they made good time toward their goal. Only the weather stopped them. After a few days' travel down the coast, a dark and threatening mountain of clouds appeared over the ocean. At first, the storm seemed reluctant to come ashore, building up its nerve over a slow 24 hours, the air pressure changing in a way that made the hoverboards jittery to ride. The storm gave plenty of warning, but when it finally arrived, it was much worse than Tally had imagined weather could be. She'd never faced the full force of a hurricane, except from within the solid structures of her inland city. It was another lesson in nature's savage power. For 3 days, Tally and David huddled in a plastic tent in the shelter of a rock outcrop, burning chemical glow sticks for heat and light, hoping the magnets in the hoverboard wouldn't bring down a lightning strike. For the first hours, the drama of the storm kept them fascinated, amazed at its power, wondering when the next peal of thunder would shake the cliffs. Then the driving rain became simply monotonous, and they spent a whole day talking to each other about anything and everything, but especially their childhoods, until Tally was sure that she understood David better than anyone she'd ever known. On their third day trapped in the tent, they had a terrible fight. Tally could never remember about what, that ended when David stormed out and stood alone in the icy wind for a solid hour. When he finally returned, it took him hours to stop shivering, even wrapped in her arms.
"We're taking too long," he finally said.
Tally squeezed tighter. It took time to prepare subjects for the operation, especially if they were older than 16. But Dr. Cable wouldn't wait forever to turn David's parents. Every day the storm delayed them, there was a greater chance that Maddie and Az had already gone under the knife. For Shay, the perfect age for turning, the odds were even worse. "We'll get there. Don't worry. They measured me every week for a year before I was supposed to turn. It takes time to do it right." A shudder passed through his body.
"Tally, What if they don't bother to do it right? The storm ended the next morning, and they emerged to find that the world's colors had been transformed. The clouds were bright pink, the grass an unearthly green, and the ocean darker than Tally had ever seen it, marked only by the foam crests of waves and a peppering of driftwood driven into the sea by the wind. They rowed all day to make up for lost time, in a state of shock, amazed that the world could still exist after the storm. Then the railway turned inland, and a few nights later, they reached the rusty ruins. The ruins looked smaller, as if the spires had shrunk since Tally had left them behind more than a month before, headed to the smoke with nothing but Shay's note and a knapsack full of spag bowl. As she and David passed through the dark streets, the ghosts of the Rusties no longer seemed to threaten from the windows. "The first time I came here at night, this place really scared me," she said. David nodded. "It's kind of creepy how well preserved it is. Of all the ruins I've seen, it looks the most recent. They sprayed it with something to keep it up for school trips." And that was her city in a nutshell, Tally realized. Nothing left to itself. Everything turned into a bribe, a warning, or a lesson. They stowed most of their gear in a collapsed building far from the center, a crumbling place that even truant uglies would probably avoid, packing only water purifiers, a flashlight, and a few food packets. David had never been any closer to the city than the ruins, so Tally took the lead for once, following the vein of iron that Shay had shown her months before. "Do you think we'll ever be friends again?" she asked as they hiked toward the river, lugging their boards for the first time the entire trip.
"You and Shay? Of course."
"Even after you and me?"
"Once we've rescued her from the specials, I figure she'll forgive you for just about anything."
Tally was silent. Shay had already guessed that Tally had betrayed the smoke. She doubted anything would ever make up for that. Once they reached the river, they shot down the white water at top speed, glad to be finally free of the heavy saddlebags. With the spray hitting her face, the roar of water all around her, Tally could almost imagine this was one of her expeditions, back when she was a carefree city kid and not a... What was she now? No longer a spy, and she couldn't call herself a smoky anymore. Hardly a pretty, but she didn't feel like an ugly either. She was nothing in particular, but at least she had a purpose. The city came into view. "There it is," she called to David over the churning water. "But you've seen cities before, right?"
"I've been this close to a few, but not much closer."
Tally gazed down at the familiar skyline, the slender trails of fireworks silhouetting the party towers and mansions. She felt a pang of something like homesickness, but much worse. The sight of New Pretty Town had once filled her with longing. Now the skyline was like a vacant shell, all its promises gone. Like David, she had lost her home. But unlike the smoke, her city still existed, right in front of her eyes, but emptied of everything it had once meant. "We've got a few hours before sunrise," she said. "Want to take a look at special circumstances?"
"The sooner the better," David said.
Tally nodded, her eyes tracing the familiar patterns of light and darkness surrounding the city. There was time to make it there and back before daybreak. "Let's go." They followed the river as far as the ring of trees and brush that separated Uglyville from the suburbs. The Greenbelt was the best place to travel without being seen, and a good ride as well.
"Don't go so fast," David hissed from behind as she whipped through the trees.
She slowed down. "You don't have to whisper. No one comes here at night. It's ugly territory, and they're all in bed, unless they're tricking."
"Okay," he said, "but shouldn't we be more careful about hover paths?"
"Hover paths?" "David, hoverboards work everywhere in the city. There's a metal grid under the whole thing."
"Oh. Right."
Tally smiled. She had been so used to living in David's world It was good to be explaining things to him for once.
What's the matter? She taunted. Can't keep up?
David grinned. Try me. Tally turned and shot ahead, cutting a zigzag path between the tall poplars, letting her reflexes guide her. She remembered her two hovercar rides to special circumstances. They'd flown across the greenbelt on the far side of town, then out to the transport ring, the industrial zone between the middle pretty suburbs and outer Crumblyville. The hard part would be getting across the burbs, a risky place to have an ugly face. Luckily, middle pretties went to bed early. Most of them, anyway. She raced David halfway around the greenbelt, until the lights of the big hospital sat directly across the river from them. Tally remembered that first terrible morning, yanked away from the promised operation, flown out to be interrogated, her future pulled out from under her. She made a grim face, realizing that this time she was actually going out looking for special circumstances. A tingle passed through her as they left the greenbelt. A minuscule part of Tally still expected her interface ring to warn her that she was leaving Uglyville. How had she worn that stupid thing for 16 years? It had seemed such a part of her back then. But now the idea of being tracked and monitored and advised every minute of the day repelled Tally. Stick close, she said to David. This is the part where you should whisper. As a littlie, Tally had lived in the middle pretty burbs with Sol and Ellie. But back then, her world had been pathetically tiny. A few parks, the path to Littley School, one corner of the green belt where she would sneak in to spy on uglies. Like the rusty ruins, the neat row houses and gardens seemed much smaller to her now, an endless village of dollhouses. They skimmed the rooftops, crouching low. If anybody was awake, going for a late-night run or walking a dog, they wouldn't be looking up, hopefully. Their boards barely a hand's breadth above the housetops, the patterns of shingles passed underneath hypnotically. All they encountered were nesting birds and a few cats who flew or scrambled out of their way in surprise. The burbs ended suddenly. At last, a band of parks fading into the transport ring, where underground factories stuck their heads above ground and cargo trucks drove concrete roads all day and night. Tally lofted her board and gained speed. Tally, David hissed. They'll see us. Relax. Those trucks are automatic. Nobody comes out here, especially at night. He stared down at the lumbering vehicles nervously. Look, they don't even have headlights. She pointed down at a giant road train passing below, the only light coming from it a dim red flicker from underneath, the navigation laser reading the barcodes painted on the road. They rode on, David still anxious at the sight of moving vehicles below. Soon, a familiar landmark rose above the industrial wasteland. See that hill? Special circumstances is just below it. We'll climb up top and take a look. The hill was too steep to put a factory on, and apparently too big and solid to flatten with explosives and bulldozers, so it stood out on the flat plain like a lopsided pyramid, steep on one side and sloping on the other, covered with scrub and brown grass. They skimmed up the sloping side, dodging a few boulders and hard scrabbled trees until they reached the top. From this height, Tally could see all the way back to New Prettytown, the glowing disk of the island about as big as a dinner plate. The outer city was in darkness, and below her, the low brown buildings of special circumstances were lit only with the harsh glare of security lights. Down there, she said, her voice falling to a whisper. Doesn't look like much. Most of it's underground. I don't know how far down it goes. They stared at the cluster of buildings in silence. From up here, Tally could see the perimeter wire clearly, stretching around the buildings in an almost perfect square. That meant serious security. There weren't many barriers in the city. Not that you could see, anyway. If you weren't supposed to be someplace, your interface ring just politely warned you to move along. That fence looks low enough to fly over.
Tali shook her head. It's not a fence. It's a sensor wire. You get within 20 meters of it, and the specials will know you're there. Same goes if you touch the ground inside it.
20 meters? Too high to clear on boards.
So what do we do? Knock on the gate?
There's no gate that I can see. I went in and out by hover car.
David drummed his fingers on his board.
What about stealing one?
A hover car?
Tali whistled.
That'd be a pretty good trick. I knew uglies who used to go joyriding, but not in special circumstances, hover cars.
It's too bad we can't just jump down.
Tali narrowed her eyes.
Jump?
From here. Get on our hoverboards back at the bottom of the hill, zoom up at maximum speed, then jump off from about this spot. We'd probably hit that big building dead center.
Dead is right. We'd splat.
Yeah, I guess. Even with crash bracelets, our arms would probably yank out of their sockets after a fall like that. We'd need parachutes.
Tali looked down, plotting trajectories from the hilltop, shushing David when he started to speak again, the wheels of her brain spinning. She remembered the party at Garbo Mansion, which seemed like years ago. Finally, she allowed herself to smile.
Not parachutes, David. Bungee jackets.
Accomplices.
There's enough time, if we hurry.
Enough time to what?
To drop by the Uglyville Art School. They have bungee jackets in the basement. A whole rack of spares.
David took a deep breath.
Okay.
You're not scared, are you?
I'm not... He grimaced. It's just that I've never seen this many people before.
People? We haven't seen anyone.
Yeah, but all those houses on the way here? I keep thinking of people living in every single one. All crowded together like that.
Tali laughed. You think the burbs are crowded? Wait until we get to Uglyville.
They headed back, taking the rooftops at top speed. The sky was pitch black, but by now Tali could read the stars well enough to know that the first notes of dawn were only a couple of hours away. Reaching the greenbelt, they turned back the way they'd come, neither of them speaking, concentrating instead on navigating through the trees. This arc of the belt brought them through Cleopatra Park, where Tali threaded the slalom poles for old time's sake. Her instincts twitched as they passed the path down to her old dorm. For a split second, it felt as if she could make the turnoff, climb in through her window, and go to bed. Soon the jumbled spires of Uglyville Art School rose up, and Tali brought the two of them to a halt. This part was easy. It seemed like a million years ago that Tali and Shay had borrowed one of the school's bungee jackets for their final trick, Shay's leap onto the new uglies in the dorm library. Tali retraced her steps to the exact window they'd jimmied, a dirty, forgotten pane of glass concealed behind decorative bushes, and found that it was still unlocked. Tali shook her head. This sort of burglary had seemed so daring 2 months before. Back then, the library stunt was the wildest prank she and Shay could dream up. Now she saw tricks for what they were, a way for uglies to blow off steam until they reached 16. Nothing but a meaningless distraction until their mutinous natures were erased by adulthood, and the operation.
Give me the flashlight, and wait here.
She slipped in, found the rack of spares, grabbed two bungee jackets, and was out in less than a minute. When she pulled herself out of the window, she found David staring at her with wide eyes.
What?
She asked.
You're just so good at this. So confident. It makes me nervous just being inside city limits.
She grinned. This is no big deal. Everyone does it. Still, Tali was happy to impress David with her burglary skills. In the last few weeks, he'd taught her how to build a fire, scale a fish, pitch a tent, and read a contour map. It was nice to be the competent one for a change. They crept back to the greenbelt and reached the river before the sky had even shown a sliver of pink. Zooming past the white water and onto the vein of ore, they sighted the ruins just as the sky was beginning to change. On the hike down, Tali asked, "Tomorrow night, then?"
"No point in waiting."
"No." And there was every reason to attempt the rescue soon. It had been more than 2 weeks since the invasion of the smoke. David cleared his throat.
"So, how many specials do you think will be in there?"
"When I was there, a lot, but that was during the day. I assume they have to sleep sometime."
"So it'll be empty at night."
"I doubt that, but maybe just a few guards." She didn't say more. Even one special would be more than a match for a pair of uglies. No amount of surprise would make up for the cruel pretty's superior strength and reflexes. "We'll just have to make sure they don't see us."
"Sure. Or hope they've got something else to do that night."
Tali trudged ahead, exhaustion taking over now that they were safely out of the city, her confidence ebbing with every step. They'd traveled all this way without thinking very hard about the task ahead of them. Rescuing people from special circumstances wasn't just another ugly trick, like stealing a bungee jacket or sneaking up the river. It was serious business. And although Croy, Shay, Maddie, and Az were probably all prisoners in those horrible underground buildings, there was always the possibility that the Smokies had been taken somewhere else. And if they hadn't, Tali had no idea where they'd be inside the warren of puke-brown hallways. "I just wish we had some help," she said softly. David's hand settled on her shoulder, bringing her to a halt.
"Maybe we do."
She looked at him questioningly, then followed his gaze down toward the ruins. At the top of the highest spire, the last few flickers of a safety sparkler were sputtering out. "There were uglies down there."
"They're looking for me," he said.
"So what do we do?"
"Is there any other way back to the city?" David asked.
"No. They'll come hiking right up this path."
"Then we wait."
Tali squinted, peering at the ruins. The sparkler had faded, and nothing was visible in the dawn light just starting to spill across the sky. Whoever was down there had waited until the last possible minute to head for home. Of course, if they were looking for David, these uglies were potential runaways. Rebellious seniors, not that worried about missing breakfast. She turned to David. "So, I guess uglies are still looking for you. And not just here."
"Of course," he said. "The rumors will go on for generations, in cities all over, whether I'm around or not. Lighting a sparkler doesn't usually get an answer. So it'll be a long time before even the uglies I've met figure out I'm not showing up. And most of them already don't even think the smoke..."
His voice caught, and Tali took his hand. For a moment, he'd forgotten that the smoke didn't, in fact, exist anymore. They waited in silence, until the sound of scrambling feet came across the rocks. It sounded like three or so uglies, talking in low tones, as if still wary of the ghosts of the rusty ruins. "Watch this," David whispered, pulling a flashlight from his pocket. He stood and pointed the light up at his own face, switching it on.
"Looking for me?"
he said in a loud, commanding voice. The three uglies froze, wide-eyed and open-mouthed. Then the boy dropped his board, and it crashed onto the stones beside him, breaking their paralysis.
"Who are you?" one of the girls managed. "I'm David."
"Oh, you mean you're...
real?"
He switched off the light and grinned.
"Yeah, I get that question a lot."
Their names were Sussy, Anne, and Dex, and they had been coming to the ruins for a month now. They'd heard rumors about the smoke for years, since an ugly in their dorm had run away.
"I just moved to Uglyville," Sussy said, "and Ho was a senior. When he disappeared, everyone had these crazy theories about where he'd gone."
"Ho?" David nodded. "I remember him. He stayed for a few months, then changed his mind and came back. By now, he's a pretty.
But he really made it? To the smoke? Anne asked.
Yeah, I took him there.
Wow. So it's real.
Anne shared an excited look with her two friends. We want to see it too.
David opened his mouth, then closed it. His eyes drifted away to one side.
You can't, Tally spoke up. Not right now.
Why not? Dex asked.
Tally paused. The truth, that the smoke had been destroyed by an armed invasion, seemed too far-fetched. A few months ago, she wouldn't have believed what her own city was capable of. And if she admitted that the smoke was gone, the rumor would make its way down through generations of uglies. Dr. Cable's work would be complete. Even if a few rescued Smokies somehow managed to create another community in the wild.
Well, she started, every so often the smoke has to move, to stay secret. Right now, it doesn't really exist. Everyone's scattered, so we're not recruiting.
The whole place moves? Dex said.
Whoa.
Anne frowned.
Hang on, if you're not recruiting, then why are you here?
To do a trick, Tally said. A really big one. Maybe you could help us. And then when the smoke is back on its feet, you'll be the first to know.
You want us to help? Like an initiation? Dex asked.
No, David said firmly. We don't make anyone do anything to get into the smoke. But if you do want to help, Tally and I would appreciate it.
We just need a diversion, Tally said.
Sounds like fun, Anne said. She looked at the others, and they waggled their heads.
Up for anything, Tally thought, just like she used to be herself. They were definitely seniors, less than a year behind her, but she was amazed at how young they seemed.
David stared at Tally along with the others, waiting for the rest of her idea. She had to come up with a diversion right away. A good one, something that would intrigue the specials enough to investigate. Something that would make Dr. Cable herself take notice.
Well, you'll need a lot of sparklers.
No problem. And you know how to get into New Pretty Town, right?
New Pretty Town?
Anne looked at her friends. But don't the bridges report everyone who crosses the river?
Tally smiled, always happy to teach someone a new trick.
Over the Edge. The two waited all day in the rusty ruins, patches of sunlight crawling across the floor through the crumbling roof, like slow searchlights marking the hours. It took Tally ages to get to sleep, imagining the leap from the hilltop down into uncertainty. Finally, she passed out, too tired to dream. Awakening at dusk, she found that David had already packed two knapsacks with everything they might need during the rescue. They hoverboarded to the edge of the ruins, riding two sandwich hoverboards each. Hopefully, they would need the extra boards when they emerged from special circumstances, escapees in tow. Eating breakfast by the river, Tally took time to appreciate her swede balls. If they got caught tonight, at least she would never have dehydrated food again. Sometimes Tally felt she could almost accept brain damage if it meant a life without reconstituted noodles. As darkness fell, Tally and David reached the white water, and they passed through the green belt at the very moment the lights winked off in Uglyville. By midnight, they were atop the hill overlooking special circumstances. Tally pulled out her binoculars and trained them inward toward New Pretty Town, where the party towers were just coming alight. David blew into his hands, his breath visible in the October chill.
You really think they'll do it?
Why not? She said, watching the dark spaces of the city's largest pleasure garden. They seemed into it.
Yeah, but aren't they taking a big risk? I mean, they just met us.
She shrugged. An ugly lives for tricks. Haven't you ever done something just because a mysterious stranger intrigued you?
I gave my gloves to one once, but it got me into all kinds of trouble.
She lowered the binoculars and saw that David was smiling.
You don't look as nervous tonight, she said.
I'm glad we're finally here, finally ready to do something. And after those three kids agreed to help us, I feel like
this might actually work?
No, something better.
He looked down at the special circumstances compound. They were so ready to help, just to make trouble, just to play a trick. At first, it killed me to hear you act like the smoke still existed. But if there are enough uglies like them, maybe it will again.
Of course it will, she said softly. David shrugged. Maybe, maybe not. But even if we blow it tonight, and both wind up under the knife, at least someone will still keep fighting. Making trouble, you know?
I hope it's us, making trouble, Tally said.
Me too.
He drew Tally closer and kissed her. When he released her, Tally took a deep breath and closed her eyes. It felt better to kiss him, more real, now that she was about to begin undoing the damage she had done.
Look, David said. In the dark spaces of New Prettytown, something was happening. She raised her binoculars. A shimmering line cut its way across the black expanse of the pleasure garden, like a bright fissure opening in the earth. Then more lines appeared, one by one, tremulous arcs and circles sweeping through the darkness. The various segments seemed to sparkle into existence in random order, but they eventually formed letters and words. Finally, the whole glittering thing was finished, some parts of it newly sprung to life, the first few lines already starting to fade as the sparklers exhausted themselves. But for a few moments, Tally could read the whole thing, even without her binoculars. From Uglyville, it must have been huge, visible to anyone staring longingly out their window. It said, "The smoke lives." As Tally watched it fade, breaking down into random lines and arcs again as the sparklers extinguished, she wondered if the words were really true.
"There they go," David said.
Below them, a large circular opening had appeared in the largest building's roof, and three hover cars rose up through the gap in quick succession, screaming toward the city. Tally hoped that Anne, Dex, and Sussy had followed her advice and were long gone from New Prettytown. "Ready?" she said. In answer, David tightened the straps of his bungee jacket and jumped onto his boards. They rode down the hill, turned around, and started back up. For the 10th time, Tally checked the light on the collar of her jacket. It was still green, and she could see David's light bobbing along beside her. No excuses now. They gained speed as they climbed toward the dark sky, the entire hill like a giant ramp before them. The wind pushed Tally's hair back, and she blinked as bugs pinged against her face. She slid carefully toward the front of the paired boards, the toes of one grippy shoe sticking out past the riding surface. Then the horizon seemed to slip away in front of her, and Tally crouched, ready to jump. The ground disappeared. Tally pushed off with all her strength, forcing her hoverboards down the steep side of the hill, where they would bring themselves to a halt. She and David had switched off their crash bracelets. They didn't want the boards following them over the wire. Not yet. Tally soared into midair, still climbing for a few more seconds. The outer city lay below her, a vast patchwork of dark and light. She spread her arms and legs. At the peak of her arc, the silence seemed to overwhelm everything. Her stomach-churning weightlessness, the mix of excitement and fear rushing through her, the wind against her face. Tally tore her eyes from the silently waiting earth and dared a glance back at David. Hardly an arm's length away, he was looking back at her, his face alight. She grinned at him and turned back to see that the ground was approaching now, the speed of her fall building slowly. As she'd calculated, they were coming down right in the middle of the wire. Tally began to anticipate the sickening jolt of her bungee jacket pulling her up. For long moments, nothing happened, except the ground getting closer
and Tally wondered again if bungee jackets could handle a fall from this distance. 100 versions of what a hard landing would feel like managed to squeeze into her head. Of course, it probably wouldn't feel like anything. Ever again. The ground grew closer and closer until Tally was certain something had gone wrong. Then, with sudden violence, the straps of the jacket came alive, cutting cruelly into her thighs and shoulders, crushing the air from her lungs, the pressure building as if a huge rubber band were wrapped around her, trying to bring her to a halt. The bare dirt of the compound rushed up toward her, looking flat and packed and hard, the jacket fighting her momentum desperately now, crushing her like a fist in its grasp. Finally, the invisible rubber band stretching toward its breaking point, she slowed to a shuddering halt within reach of the ground, pulling her hands back to keep from touching it, her eyeballs straining forward as if they wanted to pop out of her skull. Then her fall reversed, and she pulled back upward, hover bouncing head over heels, sky and horizon spinning around her like a playground ride. Tally had no idea where David was, or where up and down were, for that matter. This jump was 10 times her plunge off Garbo Mansion. How many bounces would it take to come to a stop? Now she was falling again, the dirt of the compound replaced by a building below her. 1 foot almost touched down onto the roof, but Tally was pulled up again, still barreling forward with the momentum of her leap off the hill. She managed to orient herself, sorting out up and down just in time to see the edge of the roof coming toward her. She was overshooting the building. Flailing in the grasp of the jacket, flying helplessly upward and then down again, she passed the roof's edge. But her outstretched hand caught a rain gutter, bringing Tally to a sudden halt. "Phew," she said, looking down. The building wasn't very tall, and Tally would bounce in her jacket if she fell. But the moment her feet touched the ground, the wire would sound an alarm. She gripped the rain gutter with both hands. But the bungee jacket, satisfied that her fall had stopped, was shutting itself down, gradually returning her to normal weight. She struggled to pull herself up onto the roof, but the heavy knapsack full of rescue equipment dragged her downward. It was like trying to do a pull-up wearing lead shoes. She hung there, out of ideas, waiting to fall. Footsteps came toward her along the roof, and a face appeared. David. "Having trouble?" She grunted an answer, and he reached over, grabbing a strap of the knapsack. The weight mercifully lifted from her shoulders, and Tally pulled herself over the edge. David sat back onto the roof, shaking his head. "So, Tally, you used to do that for fun?" "Not every day." "Didn't think so. Can we rest for a minute?" She scanned the rooftop. No one coming. No alarms ringing. Apparently, the wire wasn't built to sense them up there. Tally smiled. "Sure. Take 2 minutes, if you want. It looks like the specials weren't expecting anyone to jump out of the sky." Inside. The roof of special circumstances had looked flat and featureless from way up on top of the hill. But standing on it, Tally could see air vents, antenna, maintenance hatchways, and of course the big circular door that the hover cars had come through, now closed. It was a wonder neither she nor David had cracked their heads hover bouncing across it. "So how do we get in?" David asked. "We should start with this." She pointed toward the hover car door. "Don't you think they'll notice if we come through there and we're not a hover car?" "Agreed. But what if we jam the door? If any more specials show up, we don't want to make it easy for them to come in after us." "Good idea." David searched through his knapsack, bringing out what looked like a tube of hair gel. He squeezed out white goo along the edges of the door, careful not to let any touch his fingers. "What's that?" "Glue. The nano kind. You can stick your shoes to the ceiling with this stuff and hang upside down." Tally's eyes widened. She'd heard rumors of tricks you could play with nanotech glue, but uglies weren't allowed to requisition it.
Tell me you haven't done that.
He smiled.